special episode of the BrandoCast. It's the first BrandoCast of the year of our Lord 2023. Holy fuck, how did we get here? We are all supposed to have jetpacks by now, but we don't. But you know what we do have? My first guest of the year. He's a heavy hitter. He's a friend in real life. You know him from movies, from television. Maybe you knew his band back in the day. He is also an author with a brand new book out in the world. It is called No Job for a Man, a memoir of sorts, if you will, written by none other than my man, John Ross Bowie.
Hi, Brendan. I didn't realize I was your first guest of the year. That's really exciting.
I wish I had like a t-shirt to give you or maybe like a little trophy. You know what I'll do? After the show is over, I will go down to one of the tchotchke stores on Hollywood Boulevard. I will buy a little plastic Oscar and just write first guest of the BrandoCast 2023.
I will graciously accept that and thank both my agent and God.
Now, as we're talking, speaking of Hollywood Boulevard, I'm going to talk about things in real time as we record this podcast. After we are done, I am walking down to Hollywood Boulevard to the area outside of Amoeba Records because Mr. William Idol is getting a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame today.
They're doing it near Amoeba. That's perfect.
I think that's now going to be anytime a band gets a star or a musician gets a star. I think they're going to do it outside. Right. They did it for the Chili Peppers and now they're doing it for Billy Idol.
That's fantastic. That is fantastic.
Do you have any thoughts on the career of Billy Idol?
You'd be surprised how fond I am of Billy Idol, maybe. Or maybe you wouldn't. I don't know. We can have the longer discussion about like what is punk, what isn't punk, but those are good rock songs. Those are just really good rock songs. And I'm not even just talking about the singles, which are kind of unimpeachable, but there's deep cuts there. Blue Highway, Do Not Stand in the Shadows, Come On, Come On. There's good shit on those early records, man. Am I surprising you? I am. You're very taken aback by how fond I am of Billy Idol. Furthermore, a couple of years ago, he opened for Morrissey at the Hollywood Bowl, and Morrissey had some balls following Billy Idol. Let me say that. Morrissey had some fucking sack following the showman that is the former William Broad. Yes, I also know his real name. How about that? Adamant is Stuart Goddard. What else you got for me?
Oh, man, the perfect person.
It is 9 a.m. It is 9 a.m. and I am ready to fucking go.
I think here's the super group podcast that I want to do in 2023.
All right.
You, Steve Agee, Jimmy Pardo.
Oh, my God.
In one room.
Oh, my God. Wow. Wow. That's a lot of nerdery. That is a lot. You know, I made the horrible mistake. If you're familiar with Jimmy Pardo, he is a Chicago native. And he is a Chicago fan, by which I mean he's really, really into the band Chicago, famously so. And I made the mistake exactly once of asking him who was currently in Chicago. And my God, it took up like 20 minutes of his podcast. That's his bandwidth. Whatever he wants to do with it is his time. But he gave me like the full roster and resume of everyone who is currently playing in Chicago. And it was frankly hilarious.
Before we get going on your book, a deep dive into No Job for a Man, I will tell you that one of the last times that I was on Jimmy Pardo's show with him and his wonderful crew of dudes, we were talking about the Cult, and he goes, I'll give nine. How much money do I have in my wallet? I've got $90 in my wallet. $90 to the first person who can tell me who opened up for the Cult in the year of our Lord, 1987, at the Riviera Theater in Chicago.
Oh, he fucked up. He fucked up. He lost 90 bucks that day, didn't he?
He did. He did.
Who was it?
Because I was there. And he saw the look on my face, and he realized, he goes, oh, no. And I was like, oh, yeah. And I let the other guys guess. And I just said, Jimmy, I'll tell you he was there because I was there. And it was Divinals.
Oh, my God.
He was so mad. He was so mad because he had to fork over the $90. But then I let him win it back.
Oh, that was very gracious of you.
I'm not going to leave his show with $90, but he had an Anthony Newley record, and he held it up for all of us, and he said, I'll double down on the money. If you could guess what year this Anthony Newley record was released, and there was just no way to guess. It was just a pure guess, and I got it within a year, but I wanted to give the money back. I was
72, 73, or earlier.
And I said it was 71. Like that was the year.
71, really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
But anyway, so there we go. Lots of talk about some of our favorite people, our music friends. But look. People, the reason that I have John Ross Bailey on this show is it's a show about music, and there are a few people in my life who know more about music than Mr. John Ross Bailey. Now, the book, No Job for a Man, is a memoir of sorts, I would think. Is that what you would call it? Is that how people are describing it?
And it really chronicles. I think it says a memoir on the cover.
Right there, and I'm holding the book in my hand. It does say a memoir, but it really chronicles John's rise from a child of Hell's Kitchen to a dude fronting a little punk band to a guy who became an integral part of the Upright Citizens Brigade in New York. And then, of course, brought those talents to the City of Angels, where he has appeared on, God damn it, so many things. What show do you think you are recognized for the most?
Oh, it's Big Bang Theory, easily. Okay. I mean, that show is enormous, and I get recognized in other countries. I mean, the story. I mean, no, seriously. Like the story I tell, like the moment I really, really understood that the show was enormous. It had just started syndicating. It had just started going into reruns, and I was working in Johannesburg, and I got stopped on the Gauteng train in Johannesburg by a law student who loved the Big Bang Theory. And I was like, I am literally on the other side of the world. It is winter in August. Like, that's how far away I am from my life. And this guy just recognized me from that CBS sitcom. Yeah, I mean, that show had a pretty enormous reach.
Oh, I remember when Johnny Galecki shot the pilot, and he said to me, I'm so glad that we shot this pilot because I needed the cash, but I really hope the show doesn't get picked up. I swear to God, he said that in his old apartment near on Fountain, not far from Crescent Heights. Cut to. Oh,
that's interesting. That's interesting. He recently sold his massive, massive house that's a little bit further up the hills from there. Good for him.
Yeah.
He actually, you know, Johnny texted me. He bought the book. He lives in Tennessee now. He completely left the city entirely. He lives in Tennessee, and he bought the book at like a Memphis Barnes & Noble or whatever. And we had a lovely little text chat about it. He's a very good, very wealthy guy.
He's a good egg, but who did not want the show to go to series, but now it has paid for a lot of amazing things in his life. Real quick, I want to say about people recognizing you. When John and I went to the Circle Jerks at the Palladium in Hollywood a number of months ago, as we were walking in, there was a crowd of young people, and one of the young people on the sidewalk outside the Palladium went, "Hey!" when John walked by, assuming that they knew you, but they did know you, but they just didn't do the math in the moment. But the way that they said it was as if, you know, you worked with them or you were a guy who, you know, was a huge part of their life. But it was really kind of a funny moment because you handled that situation incredibly well. You helped them do a soft landing on realizing that they didn't know you in real life, but they know you from TV. Do you remember that?
I handled that well because it happens quite a bit. Actually, there are the people who are like, oh wow, it's Kripke from Big Bang. But there are also the people who are like, hey, you. And I'm like, okay, it's possible we know each other, but it's more likely that I have been in that appliance in your living room, the one that all your furniture faces. And that will give you a sense of intimacy that is perhaps not earned, but is understandable. So, that happens quite. We're friends with Heather Donahue, who was the girl on the poster in the Blair Witch Project. And the nature of that movie, you know, where she's just holding a camera 6 inches from her face, was such that she got that all the time. Like, she got these concerned looks from like, oh, did I go to high school with you? And you had a problem. Something went wrong. She used to, like, the phenomenology surrounding her fame was fascinating because, you know, she played a character named Heather Donahue and she had the camera in her face for the, and that movie was fucking enormous in the summer of 99. Like, it can't be overstated how big that movie was. So we would hang out in our early days in LA and I would watch people just stare at her like, hey, we had algebra together. They were just, it's fascinating.
Well, when we were inside the Palladium at the Circle Jerks in line to get a Coke, you had a mask on and a young girl recognized you with the mask on and came on. Do you remember that? It was kind of amazing.
Wow. She heard me order the Coke. She heard the voice. I think my voice is fairly distinct.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's what, and, you know, I mean, he's the character on Big Bang has a very pronounced speech impediment, but I describe my voice as having a very unique quality of both deep and nasal, which is not the easiest thing to achieve. I get recognized post COVID. I get recognized just by my voice. Sometimes it's wild.
Do you do a lot of voiceovers? I don't know that.
I don't actually. I'm asked that a lot. It is a very specific skill, and I don't know that I have it mastered. I've gotten some gigs, like when I was working regularly for ABC. I was on an ABC show called Speechless for a while, and when I was on that, I got sort of an in at Disney, and a couple things. So it was easier to get a couple gigs there. So I did like Milo Murphy's Law, and I did an episode of Big Hero 6, and I loved doing voiceover, and I loved recording my audiobook, which was my first time doing anything like that as well. But no, it's not a steady income stream for me, as for I should take a class. I really should just take a class in like how to do cartoon voices, or because there's a weird, like, not to get too inside the actor's studio, but there's a weird technical size to a voiceover performance that I don't think I've got a handle on, that's like just a little bigger than your normal conversational on camera tone. But unless you're doing like a crazy villain, like a Batman villain or something, you don't want to go too big. And it's this alchemy that I haven't quite mastered.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, the previous guest on the BrandoCast was Mr. John DiMaggio, of course,
of
Bender. And, you know, we've been friends since he basically started doing voiceover. And so I've done a couple myself. So I know how tough that world is to crack, but yeah. You've been given the gift of an awesome voice. So I was just wondering about that. Okay. Without further ado, let's get into No Job for a Man.
Okay.
And what I was thinking, John, what I wanted to do was sort of, in my mind, I've sort of broken the book up into a few different parts. And I'd love to approach the book from a musical point of view and just sort of take everyone through it. And one of my favorite things about this book is that it really captures the spirit of New York City, where you grew up, specifically in Hell's Kitchen. So to sort of start to talk about that part of the book, I would love to know, what does your childhood New York sound like? What were the bands? Who were the bands? Who were the artists that really permeated the air, that really sort of got under your skin, that sort of sounded like the city to you?
Well, you know, it's... So I'm born in 1971, and we move in. I was born in Queens, but we move into Hell's Kitchen at when I'm about three, and so it's very much the 70s, and we're talking the West 40s, and yeah, there was what was playing in my house, which was a very specific cocktail of show tunes and light folk. By which I mean nothing like heavy, like Phil Oaks or Bob Dylan or, you know, Dave Rock, stuff like Judy Collins and Simon and Garfunkel and stuff like that. And a little bit of the more accessible Beatles stuff, like the early Beatles stuff. Because my parents aren't boomers. My parents were Silent Generation, born in 1937 and 1942, respectively. So they were, you know, rock wasn't directly for them, if that makes any sense. You know, it wasn't, they lived a life without rock music for a while. You know, their early life would have been, you know, Patti Page and Sinatra, and that's what would have been the hit parade. But New York in the 70s, outside of my apartment, I heard a ton of disco. I heard just a ton of fucking disco, like coming out of cars, coming out of apartments. And then it took me years to like sort of tune my ear to appreciate it, a ton of Latin music. There were 10th Avenue used to just be covered with these Latin music distributors, not even record stores, like wholesale distributors up and down 10th Avenue for a while. And music would come out of there and I'd be like, this is just too syncopated for my white ears. I can't, you know, there's just so much going on here that I'm not grasping. But I guess it would have been stuff like, you know, Celia Cruz or Hector Lavoe or stuff like that. But yeah, when you ask what Hell's Kitchen sounded like in the 70s, those are the two things that popped to mind. Like I heard a ton of disco, I heard a ton of Latin music. And then I start getting into music on my own volition, through local, for, you know, the local top 40 station, which was Z100, which is enormous and is still around. But then when I started to find my own stuff, the 80s sound like punk and hardcore. Cause I got,
who do you think was the first band that you went, okay, this is my band?
Definitely the Ramones. There was something about the Ramones that, and I know a lot of people say that, and there's a reason we all say it, because there was something about the Ramones that, like, if you were a certain kind of weird kid who had smart and goofy in equal measure, then a band like the Ramones with lyrics like, now I guess I'll have to tell him that I got no cerebellum. You know, there's just something smart and goofy about that couplet that I think is the ball game. They were loud, they were angry, but they had a sense of humor and they had a romantic streak. You know, and I was a total like love struck eighth grader who was, you know, constantly losing girls to taller guys, just forever losing girls to taller guys, and not even losing, like not having them in the first place. Just, you know, it just was not happening. The Ramones just had this heart on their leather sleeve quality that really spoke to me. And then there were songs about monster movies. And then even the songs about drugs. I was a straight edge kid, but I thought, you know, this is in the book. I thought Now I Want to Sniff Some Glue was the funniest song title in the world. And I still do. I just think there's something about the now at the beginning of the sentence that, that cracks me up.
Did you ever travel over to 53rd and 3rd to see what was really going on?
Well, there's nothing really there, you know. I mean, it's sort of a little corporate canyon there, which is why it was empty at night, because it was not residential at all. It's mostly there's like a Smith and Wolensky's a couple blocks down, and or maybe a block down, which would be a place for like closeted businessmen to get drunk and then come out looking for something to do. 53rd and 3rd being the song on the album that recounts Dee Dee's experience as a male hustler. Just for those of you who are not as immersed in the mythos as Brendan and I are. But yeah, so 53rd and 3rd, what's interesting about 53rd and 3rd is that it's kind of a ghost town at night. Because you would have to go like another couple blocks east before you got to the residential part. And yeah, I see where you would be able to find like a guy who wanted to discreetly hook up with another guy in that area. Yeah. But yeah, it was years before I realized what that song was about. My first My first cassette didn't have lyrics. My first cassette copy of that I bought at Tower Records didn't have a lyric sheet. So I got like the stuff that he was really screaming. But like I was 5 years into my fandom before, oh, going into a tight wind, like a plane. Oh, I got it. That's what he's saying. Okay. So there was a long discovery with the Ramones.
You mentioned Tower Records. What were your favorite record stores during that era for you?
Well, the thing about Tower is that it was the biggest at the time. It was so huge, and we'd never seen anything like it. You know, there were record stores like there was Colony and Hell's Kitchen, which isn't there anymore, or you'd see Sam Goody, you know, which was just mostly just like the really popular stuff they were selling there. You know, if you've desperately needed a cassette of Bat Out of Hell, Sam Goody had your back, you know, you're all set, you know. But Tower had this, they had an import section. I'd never seen an import section. So you could get like Canadian and British stuff that was simply not available domestically. And you'd pay a little bit extra for your Toy Dolls record or your Rare DOA record or whatever. But you know, the breadth of selection was incredible. But then once I started to realize that I just wanted to get more and more into punk rock, you inevitably headed downtown. And it's a real geographic progression for me because the Tower I'm talking about is the one up near Lincoln Center. So then I go south from there. I go to high school on 18th Street. On 23rd Street, it's a place called Midnight Records, which was a half store, half label. And the label put out a lot of like rockabilly and psychedelic stuff. So I had a very modest allowance, or I would do little odd jobs at my mom's office. My mom worked sort of book layout stuff, what we would have called typesetting, I guess. And I would, you know, do copies or just be a sort of a gopher at the office and make a little money that way. And I would just blow it all on records, especially in ninth grade, where I hadn't really found my tribe at my high school yet. I certainly didn't have a girlfriend. So I was just hemorrhaging money on records. And then 10th grade, I fall in with these girls, all of whom had mythological last names, literally Penelope, Tatiana, and Sybil. And they all lived below 14th Street. They all lived in the West Village. So that takes me further down. I discover Bleecker Bob's. I discover Second Coming Records, which was on Sullivan, I want to say, up the street from the Fantastics. And that's when we start getting into stuff that like those places sold bootlegs or, you know, really rare board tapes of like German Dead Kennedy shows and stuff like that. And then our odyssey takes us east, and there was an exclusively all hardcore record store called Some Records, which was on 6th Street, off the Bowery. And it was literally in a basement. And it really, like so much of punk rock in New York in the 80s, and I think in LA too, from what I've read, there was a real sense of like, this is a secret. Maybe you shouldn't even be here. But you literally had to like go down into this dark ass basement that had like a couple lights. But it was all hardcore. It was just all like the loudest shit you could possibly find. And I mean like hardcore. I don't mean like, you know, any of that Orange County stuff that I was enjoying, like DI or Social Distortion. This was like Youth of Today and the Cro-Mags and the really loud shit that was coming out of New York and DC at the time. So yeah, it's a real like, it was a real geographic progression from like the safety of like, oh, I'll dip my toes in around Lincoln Center of all places to like further and further, literally underground. It's kind of a Dante-esque progression now that I say it.
Well, I remember when I was a teenager and I visited Manhattan and somehow found my way to, oh my God, you mentioned it. Not Bleecker Bob's, the other great store that had all the bootlegs in the
Village. Second Coming.
Exactly. Right. Where I bought a Bruce Springsteen bootleg.
Oh, wow.
And I, you know, from like a show in like 1978. And it was so mind-blowing to me because, you know, Albuquerque, New Mexico only had Sound Warehouse. And there were a couple little cool record stores, but nothing right. like this. I mean, it was like scary and exciting and weird.
Sure.
And like, oh, my God, this is where the coolest people in the world stop. All right. Before we go on to the next section of the book that I want to talk about an important section of the book, which chronicles the rise and fall of John's punk band. What other bands, who do you think are the quintessential, just name your quintessential five New York bands.
Like, oh, they got
bands that capture, that are uniquely New York and sound like New York to you.
All right. The bands that are uniquely New York and sound like New York to me, but aren't necessarily my favorites, but
yes,
will evoke a certain era. Obviously Ramones, obviously Bad Brains, who were, I got to see them. There are people who will say, you saw them on the Eye Against Eye tour. You want to, before that was when they were insane. They were a powder keg on the Eye Against Eye. HR was doing backflips. It was unlike anything I'd ever seen. I saw the Circle Jerks open for them. Speaking of our friends, the Circle Jerks. Bad Brains were, you know, Bad Brains were one of those bands that were doing hardcore, but could have been doing anything. They had the chops to be doing fucking anything. They chose to do hardcore and chose to do it excellently. So that's probably the most, let me see, before I say this, I'm going to give it a thought. Yeah, that is probably the most technically proficient punk band on the East Coast. For West Coast, I'll give it up to the Descendants, just because Bill Stevenson is a monster drummer who could be, you know, he's like Buddy Rich back there. He's insane. He just happens to be lending his talents to punk rock. The whole band, everyone who's ever been to the Descendants is a fucking beast. All right, but you asked about New York. Okay, so Ramones, Bad Brains. I'm definitely going to go Youth of Today. Who were the to my mind the biggest of the straight edge bands, the Unity Core bands that came out of that scene. I hardly ever listened to them, and they've gone a little crazy. But the Cro-Mags were everywhere. The Cro-Mags were a little too metal for my taste, but they were. I mean, you just saw Cro-Mag shirts everywhere you went. You just saw Cro-Mag shirts everywhere because they looked, you know. That first album cover, The Age of Quarrel, is just Cro-Mags in big orange letters on top of a big orange mushroom cloud. And, you know, they were like a lot of the 80s hardcore bands, they were just humorless. Like, there was not a trace of irony in anything they did, which was such a stark contrast to Ramones, you know. And then, to flip it a little bit, one of the few New York hardcore bands with a sense of humor, who were like drunk idiots, but Murphy's Law. You ever heard of Murphy's Law?
No, I have not.
Murphy's Law. I bet you would enjoy that first Murphy's Law record, because they were New York hardcore, but they were kind of goofy, and they were an interesting band, and they were fun live. They were really fun live. And they made a really good pair. If the Dickies came to town, Murphy's Law could open for them. They were like the only New York hardcore band that made sense opening for the Dickies. Does that make any sense? You know, like,
yeah, absolutely.
There was a little bit of a hook, a little bit of like some pop hooks there, and a little bit of I can't call it self-effacing wit, but a sense of humor at the very least. But yeah, those would be my guys: Ramones, Bad Brains, Youth of Today, Cro-Mags, Murphy's Law.
Okay, so Kiss is not on that list. The Velvet Underground, not on that list. Run DMC, right. Not on that list.
Okay, fair enough. I will. Velvet Underground and Kiss are in some regards before my record buying time. Like, they're at their peak in the 70s, right? And I think we will all agree that Kiss lost some of their luster in the 80s. It's sort of shot where it goes. I don't think I'm out of line in suggesting that. I actually thought we were just talking punk rock. Yes, Run DMC, you know, even more than Run DMC, you know who I actually go back to more often than I go back to Run DMC is LL. I'm Bad is probably the first rap song that I knew top to bottom. No rapper can rap quite like I can. I think I'm a muscle band man, put his face in the sand. I there was a time where I could do that entire song off book. And I find LL fascinating. Can I talk about LL for a moment?
Yeah, do it.
I want to talk about LL Cool J for a moment, who, you know, I get, like, people are going to make fun of him because he's on NCIS and whatever, you know. But LL was a very good rapper, but he had a business acumen in the early 80s coming out of New York that I find fascinating, because here's a guy who, you know, had the same upbringing. You know, he was from, he's from like a slightly more suburban part of Queens called St. Albans. So it's a little bit like Hollis, the area that Run DMC was from. It was not a, it's not a particularly rough, you know, it was New York in the 70s and 80s, but it's not like a neighborhood that you would automatically associate with like, oh, that's, you know, that's a dangerous neighborhood. You know, it wasn't like Bedford-Stuyvesant or the South Bronx or something. But he looked around and he goes, okay, so there's all these rappers and we're all boasting and we're all sort of self-aggrandizing and we're all carrying enormous radios and we wear big jewelry, but I do not see a heartthrob. Hip hop doesn't have a sex symbol. Allow me to take my shirt off and change the game for better or for worse, you know, and you can say like, oh, well, you know, that made, you know, rap about the externals or whatever. But he decided he was going to be hip hop's Elvis. I'd be shocked if he'd admit this, but there is something very interesting about his trajectory in the way like nobody else was doing that. He was like, you know, Melly Mel was not making girls swoon. KRS-One was not making girls swoon. LL was like, hi, hip hop needs a hunk. Speaking.
Well, you know, across the river, there is John Bon Jovi who brought that same energy to heavy metal.
Uh-huh. Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. For better or for worse.
For better or for worse.
But yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, and I, you know, it's funny. Bon Jovi's a very easy fucking target, and I will take those shots, but you're 100% correct. He created a genre of like hunk metal.
Yeah.
Pretty boy metal, and presaged all that Sunset Strip stuff that came after. And you have him to thank slash blame for that shit. Let the record show. I'm not a fan. He is supposed to be one of the nicest guys you're ever going to meet.
You've probably
met him, haven't you?
You know what? I've never met Bon Jovi, but goddamn, was he big in Albuquerque, New Mexico with his first single. She's a little runaway. Okay. Moving on to the next section of the book. How do you take your love of the Ramones and turn that into a band?
The way everyone takes their love of the Ramones and turns that into a band. You buy a bass guitar from a guy who is a real serious music major at your college and is getting rid of his Gibson Ripper, which is, it was not an axe, but it was the same, that's the same brand Gene Simmons plays. And I mentioned that just because it's fucking huge, solid wood. It was enormous. I basically bought a fucking cello and strapped it onto my 148-pound frame. I was like, oh, fuck, I've made a horrible mistake here. Then I went back to my room, and I had a tape deck. I had like a dual tape deck boombox. And the thing that I think a lot of people know about the first Ramones album is that if you could get the stereo mix, which was the only one that was available, Dee Dee is isolated in the left channel. Johnny, the guitarist, is isolated in the right. So you can knock out the guitar entirely and just have bass and drums on that record. And that's how a lot of us learned how to play, by just isolating Dee Dee's and playing along to that. And the other big thing that was happening at this time is that I was in college radio. I was working in college radio, and I was, you know, listening to incredible stuff from the early 90s. So, you know, this is the big Nirvana record. It's a bunch of great Pixies records. And those Steve Albini Pixies records, you can't isolate the bass, but it's really high in the mix. Kim Deal is way the fuck up there in the mix. And like, so, you know, I learned how to play Debaser and Gigantic and This Monkey's Gone to Heaven and all that, all those early Pixies singles. And it sort of sharpened my left hand a little bit and gave me two very different approaches to songwriting. Because the Ramones are just, it's real, very, you know, we're going to do this, we're going to go up a fifth, we're going to go up in, boom. That's, you know, it's basically the blues. And then the Pixies had this sort of triangular approach to things. And then there were two other guys, both named Michael, both from Syracuse, who were at the college radio station. And when we all ended up in New York, we pulled the band together, called ourselves Egghead. I'm doing the short version here. And started writing songs and playing out. And it was, you know, the people who always say like, you know, only 100,000 people bought the first Velvet Underground record, but they all started bands. I do have the first Velvet Underground record, but it was the first Ramones record that made me think, oh, shit, I could do this.
I think it's in the book. But what was really the first Egghead show where you felt like, oh, OK, this is real. We're actually we're a real band right now.
There were a couple, you know, I there was one where I remember playing a bar in the deep West Village, almost near Tribeca. And I'm fucked if I can remember the name of the bar, which is unlike me. I've got a pretty good memory about this sort of thing. But we were opening for our friends Furious George, who were a terrific silly punk band. They were great. George Tabb, wonderful guy. We were opening for them, and we were talking to these two people outside the bar. There was this couple. They're no longer together, but they were named Frank and Heather, and we eventually started calling them Frank and Heather. and there was a bunch of bands on the bill, and I remember being like, "Oh, so who are you guys here to see?" And they kind of stared at me quizzically, and like, "We're here to see you." I'm like, "Us?" I'm like, "Yeah, we saw you at the Spiral, and now we came over here to see you again here." And I was like, "Oh, but we don't know you. Like, I don't work with you. Like, you know, I didn't go to college with you guys. You're strangers coming to see our band." And I remember that being a moment of like, oh, this isn't just people doing us a favor by coming to see my band. This is, you know, this is a real thing. We had a little stretch there where we were playing really good shows, really good bills at a couple places in the East Village, the Continental and Coney Island High, neither of which are there anymore. Coney Island High was a wonderful fucking place to play. There's some controversy over why it closed. I had initially heard they closed because they were serving underage kids, which would make sense because I was always shocked at like the number of teenagers I saw at that place. But we got on bills there with the Dickies and Sicko and all sorts of great fucking bands. I think we played with the Figs there one time. Do you know the Figs from Saratoga? They're so good. They're so like one of the most underrated bands of, they're so underrated that I'm thrilled that they still do it, you know? But they have a deep, wonderful catalog that I really recommend. We toured. We did a tour down the East Coast. We went as far as Georgia. This is all in the book because there was a brief period of time where we thought, like, is there some way where we can like put out our own records, have a label that maybe puts out some other records, and like that could be our job? Because that's what the whole book is about. The whole book is about me trying to find out what my career is going to be. And because my father used to say that acting was no job for a man. So I tried to find a bunch of different ways to like make a man type job. And adorably naively, I thought for a while it might be my punk band. But we broke up in the beginning of 98 when our guitarist moved out to LA to become a screenwriter and got a couple movies made, got a couple really good indies made. It was a breakup. I mean, it was a fucking breakup. Like I sank into a depression because I had lost like two, you know, I had not lost friends, but I'd lost the very specific relationship I had with those friends. And I no longer had any creative outlet, which freaked me out. And it led me to a crushing nervous breakdown. But it also kind of inspired me to like, I got to shake things up. So I started taking improv classes and that's how I found the job for a man. That's how I ended up becoming an actor and meeting my wife. And if you want to follow the transitive property, meeting you, Brendan. So it's all worked out.
Well, let's get into, I mean, God, people, there's so much to get into with John's life story, again, chronicled so well in No Job for a Man. I mean, we could do a half hour talking about his time at Upright Citizens Brigade, which, of course, is the factory for comic talent in America right now, still to this day, I say. But I want to know about Los Angeles. I want to know when you and Jamie Denbo, your wonderful wife, a fantastic performer and a writer in her own right.
And a Brando Cast alum.
And a Brando Cast alum. Yeah. I want to know, you guys, you know, you're doing your thing in New York. You're getting attention for your comic talent. You're performing a lot. You're performing a lot with a lot of heavy hitters. You are probably sizing yourself up against other people who are also working and realizing somewhere in your brain that you can do this too. You guys decide to move to LA What does LA sound like when you get here?
I'm glad you asked. we moved here in the beginning of 02. We drive across the country.
Just the two of you.
Just the two of us, and really just her. That's in the book as well. I don't know how to drive yet. Uh-huh. I am 30 and I do not know how to drive yet because everyone's like, well, you live in New York. And that's not really an excuse. It's an explanation, but I don't know if I would call it an excuse. My high school didn't offer driver's ed. My parents didn't own a car. On the occasions when my parents would rent a car, they were fucking terrible drivers. My father was a Brooklyn native. My mother went to high school in Ohio, but for some reason didn't learn how to drive till her 40s. And she was, oh, God rest her soul, she was a fucking terrible driver. Real actively dangerous. And like that horrible mix of like timid, but also reckless, you know, like I'm going to drive very slowly, but still hit this dumpster, you know, that kind of thing. So Jamie, God bless her, drove her boyfriend who was saddled in student loan debt, had a manager, no agent, out to LA. And I turned out to be a decent investment. I started working right after I got here. Thank God. I booked some commercials and I booked a pilot and I got really lucky. But our first place was on Wilcox and Homewood, three blocks from Amoeba Records. And I got here. I was able to, within 6 months, eliminate my student loan debt. I can't, like, I'm the opposite of a cautionary tale. I'm like the, and to wit, a lot of people saw the success that idiot Bowie was having in LA. And then they all, there was this exit. I don't want to give myself too much credit. There was a sizable exodus from New York after I moved out here. And I was like, I saw that fucking moron on NBC. There's gold in those hills, you know, but I came into this money and Amoeba Records was right there. And so this is beginning of 02. So obviously, look, I'm a white guy, Yankee Hotel Foxtrot.
I sincerely miss those heavy metal bands. I used to go see.
I don't even think I bought it. I think it was just issued to me when I walked into the store. They're like, here's your copy of Yankee Hotel Foxtrot. Have you seen them? Yes, I've seen the documentary. Thank you very much. But that album is wonderful. It really is. It is a magnificent, interesting piece of work that I do go back to. Let's see, what's going on early aughts that I was listening to? I started to get really into the John Spencer Blues Explosion and got to see them at the Palace on Vine. There were some of my steadies that I had been listening to anyway. Actually, no. Right after I moved here, Superchunk went on hiatus, and they were one of my all-time favorite bands, but they went on like a solid 9 or 10 year hiatus. So they weren't putting records out for a little spell there. But what was I getting into at the time? There was a band from Sweden called The Sounds who put out a couple of really fun records that were very 80s influenced. I remember listening to the Von Bondies a lot. I remember seeing them at Amoeba. Actually, they did a show at Amoeba that was really fun. I was listening to a lot of Outkast. Before Hey Ya came out, they put out a greatest hits record that had a new song on it called The Whole World, which was really good. It was a genuine collaboration when they were both on it.
I have a weird question.
Ted Leo. Ted Leo's solo stuff started coming out in the early aughts. And I just thought he just filled a hole for me in the way of like, he was able to be a punk rocker who grew up and he was able to keep that energy, but really push himself as a songwriter. And I was just rapturously in love with it. Hearts of Oak came out right around the time I moved to LA. And that record is just a fucking masterpiece. I love it so much.
Did you make any punk rock pilgrimages here in Southern California? Like, you know, when I got to LA in the fall of 1990, there was still some remnants of the metal scene. Like I had to go to the Rainbow. Cazares was still open. You know, I had to see those places. I did go to the Troubadour. You know, I wanted to see those places.
Yeah, I saw Ted Leo at the Troubadour, actually, on a great bill with Sha Na Na and Adam and His Package. it was really, really fun. Adam and His Package, if you don't know, is a one-man band from Philly. He's like a one-man Dead Milkman. He just really goofy songs that he does with a sequencer. Three albums that are all really, really fun. There's a song called Punk Rock Academy that I really recommend. But yeah, I went there. I went to the Rainbow Room. I hung out, saw Cypress Hill at the Rainbow Room. Just hanging out, by the way. They weren't playing. They were just sitting there. I was still drinky at the time. So, you know, I would put them, we were walking distance from the Cat and Fiddle, when we moved here, which is dangerous. So I would, you know, get shithouse two tables away from Morrissey,
who was, people should know, used to drink during the day at the Cat and the Fiddle.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is also where, I don't know if you know this, but back in the day, for people who were sex addicts, they would find out where the parties were at the Cat and the Fiddle.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And then go from there. During the day crowd. During nighttime, people listening in other parts of the world, Cat and the Fiddle was this wonderful bar, restaurant, tavern, old school place with an unbelievable patio where everyone had their birthday parties, after show parties, their first dates, whatever.
Well, it was so interesting because it was a British pub in a Spanish architecture building. So it was this fascinating place for specifically British expats in L.A., which is why you found Morrissey there. So there'd be like this Spanish tile and then pints of lager as far as you could get a Scotch egg there. You could literally get a Scotch egg, which is a Scottish quote unquote delicacy, which is a hard boiled egg coated in spiced sausage and then flash fried. You have one once a year or you die. If you have two Scotch eggs in the same year, you have a heart attack. That's how that works. But I have one on my birthday every year.
You do?
I do. They've moved down to a less impressive building on Highland now. But yeah, in the early aughts, Cat and Fiddle was walking distance from our seedy little apartment. And it's where I went to, it's where I turned 31. It's where I celebrated booking a pilot. It's where everyone else celebrated their birthdays.
It's where Jeremy Piven hit on my ex-girlfriend.
Sure, that sounds about right. There were a bunch of dartboards in the back, you know, to make it really Britishy. But again, it was LA, so you could sit outside on this gorgeous patio in this fake hacienda and eat British food. It was actually, now that I think of it, it was such a wonderful, as an Anglophile who also loves LA, it was such a special place to me.
Oh, I miss that place. It's a tragedy that it was taken from us, but the city hates its own history.
It really does,
and
man.
We'll bulldoze over anything to make something fucking new. John, I'm going to say some words to you that I think are going to disappoint you.
Oh, dear.
But we have come to the end of our mission today, which was to podcast together successfully.
We covered a lot of ground, though.
We did.
I like this.
We did, and I want people to know that they need to read this book because it's so fun. It's so well written. It's so dense. It's so funny. It is so magical. It is a huge accomplishment, sir.
Thank you, man. That means
a
lot.
To pull this off.
I appreciate that.
Let everyone know, you know, where they can get it, how they can get the audio book. And I also want you to give a promotional plug for people living in LA for the incredible show that you do with your wife at the Yard Theater on Melrose. So take a minute to promote.
So the first Sunday of every month going forward for the foreseeable future, my wife and I do a two-person show called Super Married. We met doing improv, so it's kind of our fun little date night at the Yard Theater on Melrose and Heliotrope, right near LACC. We do that the first Sunday of every month.
And the Ukrainian Cultural Center, right, which used to be a punk rock venue.
Famous, there's a famous Black Flag show that occurred there. But the book can be purchased at your better bookstores. There's a few bookstores here in LA that have signed copies. Chevalier's, Romans in Pasadena, the Barnes & Noble at the Grove, the Barnes & Noble on Ventura, all have signed copies last I checked. And you can also go through your online, I recommend going through a bookshop, which is a great place that will, that funnels money to mom and pop bookstores. And the audiobook is available wherever you get your audio books. And it was really fun to do the audiobook. It was a different, experience. It was very, to read the entire book over the course of 4 days out loud was pretty intense. Because, you know, there is a lot of funny stuff in there. There's also a lot of like emotional shit. There's a lot of stuff about my dad and depression and my discovery of online porn and the breakup that that followed. But I'm happy with the audiobook. And again, if you enjoy this peculiar cocktail of deep yet nasal, and you want to keep me in your car with you for 7 hours or so, I recommend the audiobook. No Job for a Man.
Dude, thank you. That's all I can say. Thank you. To be continued, to be continued, to be continued.
This was great, man. Thanks for having me.
Now, of course. And to the rest of you, thank you so much for liking, listening, subscribing. So many great guests coming down the pike in 2023. But number one, with a bullet, is John Ross Bowie. And of course, the Brandocast is produced by Mr. Richard Sheltinga. So until the next time, cats and kittens.